And that's important because part of those, I think, decolonizing relationships and in this process of being in good relation with each other also means stepping out of sometimes toxic places.
All right, well, welcome to the final episode of the Todos Mathematics for All first ever season one, final episode of our first season of podcast. So this is our 12th and final episode for this season, and we will be returning in September with season two. Meanwhile, Todos is up to a whole lot. We have been having many Todos Live webinars, quick talks on equity. We've got new position statements coming out. Lots and lots of new energy coming out of our current Black Lives Matter moment. In today's episode, I talked with Brianna Rodriguez and Carrie Coca. As you all know, there's a lag time between when guests are interviewed and when we release episodes. And in this case, we spoke a little over a month ago, and wow, has this month felt like just a dramatic shift in our world. We've seen mass protests sparked by the murders of George Floyd and others, leading to the momentum in the Black Lives Matter movement. We have our ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, still creating a lot of fear and uncertainty for all of us as we try to get a handle on the coming school year. And as many of our prominent public intellectuals have noted, we are living history right now. And once again, I'm grateful to the conversation I had with these two amazing guests who shared their views on relationships between mentors and mentees.
My name is Brianna Rodriguez. I go by Brie, pronouns they or she. And I am a compassionate and empathetic person who also happens to be a PhD student right now and is a former math educator, born and raised in LA and gone to school in LA Unified and taught for LA Unified too.
My name is Carrie Coca. I use she, her pronouns. I am a former New York City math teacher organizer and assistant professor of mathematics education at the University of Pittsburgh. I study social justice mathematics, and I'm one of the co-founders of the Creating Balance in an Unjust World conference on STEAM education and social justice, and I am originally from the Bay Area, California.
Just some really wonderful thoughts about how we move through this world, how we interact with others, and how we cultivate relationships. I'm going to say it one more time. Relationships. This is going to be the key word for all mathematics teachers as we enter the unknowns of fall 2020. Will we or won't we return to school in person? What will happen? Well, I know my home institution of SF State is going to be fully online this fall, with the rare exception of particular essential classes. And maybe those conversations are still happening at your home institutions and your school districts. Brianna is Carrie's doctoral student at the University of Pittsburgh. In our conversation, I was intrigued by both of their perspectives as mentor and mentee of how each ended up coming to see their relationship the way they do and how they make sense of what it takes to have a solid relationship. They also speak to the roles of high school teachers to develop deep relationships with students, which is not something that we're necessarily talking about enough, about how high school mathematics teachers necessarily see this as their job, right? We tend to prioritize content in the high school math classroom, but we're going to take the perspective of how we build those relationships, because we know relationships matter. We know that caring relationships matter. And in our current ongoing pandemic and Black Lives Matter moment, this is the essential time to rethink meaningful relationships in academic settings. Let's listen to what they have to say.
Honestly, I mean, so this is like my third year of graduate education, first in like doing a master's program and not actually thinking that I was going to go on to do a PhD program, but here I am now.
Mm-hmm. Did you do your master's at Pitt too, or did you do it somewhere else?
I did my master's at UCLA in the human development and psychology program.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And it was really great. And, you know, I had several mentors there. And so coming into Pitt, I kind of had this, I was already thinking about the type of mentor relationship I wanted to have because of, you know, just like hearing the experiences of different colleagues, peers, siblings as well. I have a sister who's also in a PhD program. And, you know, I was just thinking about what is it that I need in order to be successful in graduate education? But not just in graduate education, just like in general in life. I was going to be moving for the first time from LA all the way cross country, and just thinking about teachers that I may need in this universe, right? And being in this new place. So here I am with Carrie, and you know, we'd been just getting along really, really great. And more than just getting along, just very much tapping into, I don't know, the reciprocity that comes with actually working with someone versus working for someone. And that was something that was really profound for me, that I didn't realize that I always needed, and just always wanting to be in a mentor-mentee relationship that was reciprocal, and is acknowledged as reciprocal, and then for that reason can flourish in ways that I hadn't really anticipated, like in my work, but also in like the personal healing work that we also do, right? Because that's also part of this graduate education process, is, or even just this life process, is you know, just thinking about the ways in which our own past experiences shape our future experiences, and thus also that means past relationships, you know, influence future relationships. And so in just, you know, this conversation that I was having with Carrie, I brought it up to her because I thought that this was something worth talking about, and this was something worth, you know, worth hearing about for other people as well.
Was that before you applied to Pitt, or like, was that in the process of trying to figure out, well, where should I go? Or had you decided where you wanted to go? Or
I had actually already decided where I wanted to go. So this idea didn't actually come up probably until about last semester. So this is my first year. So like mid semester of like the, like somewhere in, yeah, the second semester, something like that. Yeah. Yeah, definitely when I met Carrie, it was one of those situations where I was like, I have to work with you. Like, I don't know how. I've never met you before, but like, it was instant for me. Like, we both laughed instantly together, and that was great. And that was just like my interview. So it was really cool and really dope to just be in conversation with someone where it actually feels like a conversation, and it didn't feel like this kind of hierarchical relationship that sometimes you can feel within talking to other academic professionals, right? And that was something that was really profound for me too, was to be able to have that and see that, and I think that's something that's really important.
I think it's also really interesting to note that, like, you got yourself all the way there, though, you know, because sometimes I think that some of our listeners, all 15 of them, some of our listeners are teachers who are thinking about, you know, well, should I, shouldn't I, what would I want to do if I did my PhD or EdD or took some kind of next step, right? But you had already decided you were going into grad school. You knew where you wanted to go and all that work. So I'm curious, like, what's your advice to teachers who are thinking that they might want to do this step? You know, what are lessons you've learned or from your process?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I had decided that I had wanted to do my master's, but I didn't want to do the general, you know, everybody talks about doing like the administrative credential and then getting the master's at the same time. And I don't know, I just didn't see myself as an administrator. Not that I didn't see myself as a leader, but just not working within administration in, you know, secondary education. And so my advice was really just, or, you know, just the way that it worked out for me was, I remember being at a happy hour with a colleague and being like, I just really want to understand why, you know, I want to understand what is it that blocks people from learning math when they have the opportunities in front of them, but there's still these mental blocks happening. And so I remember just wanting to, having this profound desire to resolve a question that I had been dealing with for a long time, right? Like, why... Why is it that, you know, I can give everything, and we do, we give our heart and our soul and our tears to our classrooms. And then, you know, and then sometimes we still feel like it wasn't enough. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that was initially what fueled my desire to want to go back to grad school was, how can I do more? Mm. And so I think that that is probably my first advice, is thinking about what are the reasons for entering? Because really, if you're just doing it just to get a master's, it's really not that worth it to get into, to go through the whole like academic institution to, and this is just like my experience with just institutions in general. You know, like institutions tend to have a certain way of doing things that are very traditional. And so when you enter that institution, that means that what it is that you're learning is what someone else has deemed appropriate of what should be traditional. And mm-hmm. oftentimes that is a very Eurocentric curriculum. And that was not necessarily the population of the students that I was teaching, right? The majority of my students were Black, Brown, Indigenous. And so that was something else that I wanted to make sure that I knew for myself was really important, was maintaining that relationship with my own community, with greater communities that I'm in solidarity with as well. And so for that reason, I needed to, going into even just graduate school in general, I was just thinking about what are the ways that I can hold on to my own identity while also still being in the institution. Mm. And so that was also part of that, you know, mentor-mentee relationship, right? Is being able to have someone to support you in the ways in which you want to be in this world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Carrie, did you have a kind of a similar, I think I remember that your story is a little different of how you ended up in a doc program, but do you want to share a little of your journey into it?
Yeah. So actually, Bree, it's funny that you talk about this idea of getting an administrative credential. And so I actually have my principal certification. I did one of those programs in New York City called the New York City Leadership Academy. My principal and my assistant principal were both retiring at the same time. And a colleague and I both did that program together. And I also, at that same time, was part of someone's dissertation study. And so he's now my friend, Keith Catone, turned his dissertation into this book called The Pedagogy of Teacher Activism. And so I think that experience of being part of somebody's research project planted that seed in my head, because I realized that administration really wasn't the role for me. I really did not want to have to be the person who would have to deal with, you know, God forbid the police get involved in anything. You know, I just figured mm-hmm. I'm going to be that person on the news who's arrested because I am physically blocking the doors and not allowing the police in my space, you know? And so I applied to graduate school. And also, you know, I was doing this organizing work outside of my classroom, and I was bringing my students to protests and rallies, but I still was struggling to figure out how do I fuse that into my actual mathematics classroom. And so doing a doctoral program was the perfect avenue to continue to explore those questions.
I really appreciate how you're talking about not getting your admin credential or getting it and then realizing as a question of fit, right? Because we know many, many dope principals, but it's important to recognize that there's different pathways. And it's interesting what you guys are bringing up, because I was not a high school teacher, but my husband is. And that is the thing that he's kind of talking about as a potential next step. He's like, maybe I should get my admin credential. And maybe it's because like you're faced with it every day, right? You're like, I'm either in the teacher position or I'm in the admin position. And it's really great that you're sharing stories of how there's other options, right? There's, yes, you could go into administration. You could actually go in administration and then go get a PhD. Like, there's different ways to do it.
Or stay in the classroom. Like, I never had any intention or this concept of a ladder in my head of, you know, wanting to, you know, I don't know, move in a certain type of linear or hierarchical type fashion. And to be honest, like my identity, and that's why I said in my intro, like I very much identify as a high school math teacher. And I sometimes will even talk in the present tense as if I still teach at Vanguard High School in New York City. I'll say like, oh, well, we do X, Y, and Z, right? And I don't, I mean, I left in 2011. So it's been almost 10 years now. But I mean, I admire and honor teachers so much. And even, you know, in my role now, it's, you know, I still think about going back to the classroom. That is the most rewarding job, most meaningful job that I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Like that's also, you said ladder and I was thinking pyramid. But that's also something that I was thinking about of why I didn't think that an administrative position was a good fit for me was I didn't believe in this kind of pyramid model of this hierarchical model of, you know, somehow, and this is, again, this is in a lot of traditional schools, right? Because there are other schools that don't necessarily work in this way, but the schools that I had worked at, they generally were, you know, had this kind of, okay, here's the principal that's on top. And this principal has, you know, the last word of the last say on everything from the budget to what goes on at the school. And even though there are these like school councils, it's still very much seemed like, well, the principal is that at the epitome. And then there's like still that those higher tiers, right, that come from the district. Mm-hmm. And that was not something that a model that I really believe in. I grew up in a very communal kind of area, and even in teaching, like, or I guess outside of my classroom, a lot of the mentoring that I did with students through the Latino student organizations at school were very much, you know, I worked alongside my students as if they had, and not if, because they had their own value, their own knowledge, their own experience. And I could ask them, like, what do you think about this? And I can trust that they would actually deeply think about that question, whether it be making a decision about something and, you know, also understanding that, you know, it could not work out and that that's also okay. Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't know. And that was something that I deeply value. And still do. And I think that that's something that I guess also carries within me for graduate school is really seeing the ways in which I can work with people instead of for someone or someone work for me.
Mm-hmm. I'm also really excited about what I feel is kind of a growing concentration of people who want to do things differently once they have this degree. And I kind of wonder to what extent we can do things differently when schools are set up for these kind of hierarchies of social reproduction. But the work of people like Carrie, people like yourself, Bree, and I'm hoping to contribute in ways I can, it gives me also a lot of hope that, like, if we do the work of rethinking relationships, structures, and those kinds of things, that we can shift in directions that we'd like to see. So I'd like to move us a little bit to talking about the relationship piece and to open the floor for you and Carrie to talk through what this has been like and what your experiences have been.
I guess I'll just give a framing. So, you know, Bree talked about this work that we're doing together now, and Bree invited me to work on a paper with her about advising. And she told me that she felt that our relationship was an example of a decolonized advising relationship. And I felt so honored. And so that's why I think Bree needs to, because the advisor can never be the one to say,
that's so important.
Can I just ask one thing, Carrie? Did you like immediately Google decolonized advising relationship and see if anyone had written about it?
Well, and the thing was too, was that when she said that to me, I was so like flattered, but at the same time, I said to myself, I don't even know what I do. There's not like a thing like, oh, let me make sure I do this and I don't do this. And, you know, it's just how I think a lot of it has to do with, like Bree said, is my experiences working as a high school teacher where I was following the lead of my students. It just makes sense to me to follow the lead of Bree.
Yeah. And it's funny that you say that because I remember saying decolonize, and the more I read into like literature about decolonizing, decolonize, decolonization, I've been rethinking the ways in which I also phrased it initially to you, because I was thinking about how much decolonization is such a process, right? It's thinking about the process in which, or rethinking about the ways in which we live in relation to land, to water, and to other people, and even to our plant relatives and animal relatives, right? And so because it's such a process, I've been thinking more and more about how I use the words decolonizing, and mostly because I read Nick Estes's Our history is the future. And he has a line in there that says something along the lines of colonization being constantly evolving. And because of that, decolonization has to evolve with it. And the strategies that we use in this process to continuously be in good relation with land and with the elements and with other people, part of that process is continuing. And so I've been thinking about even that, like how that has even shifted for me in the ways that we initially talked about it. And I think that's something that is critical to this, right? Is I think being able to talk about the ways in which we are in relation to each other, because that's not something that normally academia, at least in my experience and from what I've seen, like it's not something that is taught to you that you should be doing, right? Like I remember going to a couple of workshops about, you know, graduate education and how to be successful in graduate school. And a lot of them had to do with like networking and thinking about the ways in which, you know, you contact people to get information about this, this and that, but very little of that networking aspect was tied to being in good relationship with people. And while, you know, networks are very reciprocal, I think for me it was more important to think about the ways in which I could recreate safe spaces in people versus in just the space that I'm in. And that was something that through our process of even just talking about our own relationships, right? Like something I've been thinking a lot more about is safe spaces within people and within relationships with people instead of within a physical space, especially during this pandemic, right? Because we are hopefully, and I really hope anybody who's listening is in a safe space. But for those of you who are, you know, your safe spaces can be your home, or wherever it is that you are, but at the same time, it can also be in the connections that you maintain with people. And for teachers as well, right? Like sometimes our safe spaces are with our students. You know, our students bring so much joy in sometimes a world that is just, can seem hopeless. It can seem that way. But it's really not, because they remind you, these next generations and future generations really remind you of the beauty that is in living. And so that is where your safe space is, right? And in the beauty of life.
Dang, yes. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the idea of recreating safe spaces with people or in people. And are there any instances you two can remember of this process between you? Because Carrie, you're saying like, I don't know what I do, you know? I was wondering like what might be a way to notice. What do you mean by that? Like, is it hanging out? Is it like, hey, we need to do some work together? You know what I mean? Like, I hate to be so practice oriented, but
no.
I feel like this is, our listeners are going to be like, oh, well, what if it's just that you two are two really great open people? And it's like, well, that's just good for you, you know? So
what start?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to start with, I think even just our very first initial mentor-mentee meeting that we had for the school year. I remember the very first thing that we did was talk about our boundaries. We talked about our boundaries and we talked about our, you know, what works well for the both of us. So what are some things that work well for you that, you know, like what are some things that I need to be reminded of, you know, and vice versa. Like that's how I came in with thinking about, okay, what is it that I'm willing to do? And what is it that I'm not willing to do? How is it that like being really reflective about the way that I work and the ways that I also don't work, right? So like, what are the times where I just need to relax and what does that look like for me? And so even just down to like the very, very first meeting that we had, we had a conversation about norms of collaboration and the ways in which we want to work together.
Oh, that's awesome.
I remember too, we talked about our expectations of each other.
Yeah. Yeah, that we did.
So your expectations of each other. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was something that was really important for me, right? Because in me thinking about how I want to recreate that safe space and in a place where I know nothing about, you know, how is it that I can do that? And part of that is also understanding what my expectation is for myself, for others, and what are those expectations that I can also sometimes let go of, right? And being able to talk about that. And I think after that, talking out the ways in which we work in this world, it started to trickle into some of, you know, just being able to be a little bit more personable in that way.
I do think also that our identities as women of color in the academy, I do think really plays a role, because I didn't graduate all that long ago. I literally have my parents' congratulatory card on my refrigerator from graduation. You know, and so I always try to put myself in your shoes.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that you do that, because honestly, you know, I think in general, like in our lives, right, we oftentimes receive messages from lots of different places. But what I appreciate what you do, Carrie, is that you're, and I always remember this about what you said about the dissertation, like do something that you're passionate about and do something that you love. Like essentially you were telling me like, follow your heart. And that's something that for me is extremely important, because teaching was me following my heart. Like I got my BA in math and I remember everybody being like, you know, you could do anything with a BA in math. I don't know how true that is, but, you know, I just remember people saying that to me and me thinking, well, I really love to teach. You know, I really love those aha moments. I really love, you know, at the time, being Central American, you know, I never had a Central American teacher ever, even being in LA. And so for me to start teaching, you know, and I started teaching in East LA, which was not a predominantly Central American area. It's a predominantly Chicano, Chicanx, Mexican community. And currently, because it didn't used to be. And and I just remember thinking, like, I want to be able to inspire others the ways that others have inspired me. And so part of that means that I need to always follow my heart. And if I'm following my heart, then I'm always doing something, not just with good intention, but with good purpose. And I really appreciate that, because I've heard other academics in some of the advice that they've given about grad school is like, a good dissertation is a done dissertation. And
which is also true.
Which is true.
But I understand when that's juxtaposed against following your heart. Yes, I hear what you're saying.
Right. And that's what I mean. It's like I want to make sure that when I do finally get to that phase, knock on wood.
When you do, yes.
Yeah, when I do, I want to make sure that it's something that to me can be useful for others. And that to me is following my heart, because I know that my life purpose is to be in service of other people and to be in good relation with others.
Yeah, I don't agree with that, because you write from your dissertation years after you graduate, right? So you really do need to be passionate about, I am still analyzing and publishing from that data, right? And luckily I was able to do a project that I'm passionate about. And so I really do think that it's important to study something that you really care about. But I think the other thing, I guess, that I have been reflecting on with Bree and I thinking about this advising relationship is that because the advisor can, play such a role in doctoral studies, and because now I feel like I have some power to be able to not have Bree and my other students experience the violence and the trauma of a PhD program. And so in whatever ways I can support that, whether it be the meetings that we have, or sometimes even actually where we decide to meet. Sometimes we decide to meet off campus, right? So we are able to, kind of step away from the PWI and that feeling of being surveilled. And so those are some of the things that I have been reflecting on, but the ideas are still, percolating.
And that's important, because part of those, I think, decolonizing relationships and in this process of being in good relation with each other also means stepping out of sometimes toxic places, right? And especially like all universities and a lot of the places that come from, being in a settler colonial state, right? That's something that every institution is occupying space that was once the ancestral lands of someone else, right? And like where we are here in Pittsburgh is the Lenape Seneca people. And that's part of that, right? Is understanding how to step away when you can't step away. And I think that that's something, Carrie, that you're really good at is being true to yourself. And in being true to yourself, I think that you're also just always open with your heart and always walking with your heart.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I feel that, I really do. And I think that that's something important for all of us to do. And I, I know sometimes with the institutions and just like, regardless of what job you have too, we want to close that off a little bit to make sure that that we take care of it. Right. Cause our taking care of our energy is so important, especially when sometimes there are those like energetic leeches, but that aspect is so important for you and for me, and I know so many other educators out there who do that, who walk with their heart open and leading with it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I know, Carrie, you were saying these ideas are still kind of new and everything. And I think maybe I want to try to bring it back again to the K-12 kind of mm-hmm. environment and thinking a little bit about, so what's your hunch of what some of the things you would say to teachers? I'm thinking especially math teachers who might feel like, well, I can only do so much and I do know the system better than my students. So I really just want to make sure I get them through, you know? I don't know. That's one thing that I sometimes hear, right?
One of the things that I have really been reflecting on a lot is my teaching experience at Vanguard High School. In New York City, it's a small Title I regular public school. And I taught there from 2001 to 2011. And we had a very strong advisory program. And so I realized, I've actually been an advisor for a long time. And our advisory program was a 4-year program. So whenever, let's say I had 3 seniors graduate, I would have 3 ninth graders who would come into my advisory. And then I would be with them for their whole 4-year career. And so the relationship that I developed with my advisees, as well as their families, I would text family members, I would text students, they would text me, they would accidentally call me mom because I was, as the advisor, you're the parent at school. And so,
right.
So in that way, I was very mama bear, if that makes sense. So that if a colleague disrespected one of my advisees, I'm going to have a conversation with that colleague, and vice versa. If my student did something that they need to apologize for, right, I become that liaison. But because it was this very like family feel to it, where the tables would turn where my students would give me advice, unsolicited. It was mostly like life advice, like you need to stop working so hard and we're going to help you take care of yourself. They wanted to take me shopping because I lived in New York. I wore like all black every day. They were like, okay, we're going to go to H&M. We're going to go to, they had this whole plan, things they want, but it's all out of love, right? And so those type of relationships, and they're kids who, they're not kids anymore, right? I mean, they're people, former students who I'm in touch with now, who are my chosen family. I think the other thing, like just thinking about the math classroom that really helped facilitate this outside of advisory, is that we had a double block math class for their whole 4 years. So we changed, so this speaks also to thinking about a hierarchical administrative process. My principal, Luis Delgado, very much believed in breaking down those hierarchies. And so we had a teacher leadership team and we decided to change the whole school schedule so that not only so that we could have math for a double block for 4 years, but also to give us time on Wednesdays to plan together. So the whole math team was able to meet together on Wednesdays and co-plan and do lesson study, learn more about complex instruction, learn more about performance-based assessments. And so we were doing all of this teacher-led PD with ourselves during that time. And then just thinking about achievement, because we had a lot of kids who had attended a middle school that got shut down, I'm not sure, what they learned during that time. And so for us to be able to help with some holes that they might have, we did that. So instead of taking the 3 years, they actually took 8 years worth of mathematics.
You said 8 years?
Well, they took 4 years of math in a double block. Right. So they took 8 years, the equivalent of 8 years.
Oh, but not 8 kind of classes. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, okay. So it was a lot of time in math, mm-hmm. which also means then that the math teacher or I have a small child is running around, that then the math teachers had a chance to develop deeper relationships as well. So you're involved in advisory, you're involved in supporting each other, and then you have that increased contact with your students.
Mm-hmm. And so, then also,
oh, sorry. I was going to follow up with the question of, do you think then that with the current plan for many schools to start online in the fall, I have a question for both of you that's kind of around this idea of how does this all work when you've never physically met people? Like, what are your thoughts about how, you know, what changes when you're in an online environment maybe? And also, is this a good time for maybe schools? They're messing with the schedule anyway, you know? Is this a time to kind of rethink the schedule in a way that allows for different kinds of advisory structures, planning time?
I've definitely been thinking about that, especially after, you know, just your previous question right now, and thinking about some of the ways in which we can reimagine and rethink the relationships between teachers and students. And I heard Sandy Grande speak on a talk last week where she asked this question, how are we taught to learn to value individualism? And that's something that's been really sticking with me, because I've been thinking about it like all throughout the day. Like, what are the ways in which we celebrate things about being an individual as opposed to being part of a community, right? And so I think that part of this context of how we reimagine in the future what this virtual learning might look like is specifically how can we recreate this safe space? How can we recreate a time with our students that can be much more personable, but also still build community? And I think that part of that has to come with these smaller group interactions, almost as if, I mean, I don't know if you all ever did these, but you know, when you do like the like centers and you like have your students rotate around centers, it kind of made me think about that. Like, what are the ways in which we can recreate virtual centers for students so that they're not necessarily with us in the same way all day, right? In the same subject for however some places are 90 minutes or not, but thinking about how can we stagger the amount of time that we have with students so that it's in a much more communal environment. And I think that for some schools, especially the bigger districts, rethinking that with class sizes that go beyond 36, you know, is something that is really critical, because that's something that teachers have been talking about for a really long time. In some of the smaller districts, like, you know, places like here in Pittsburgh, where some of the schools don't have class sizes that reach beyond 12 or even 16. And for the, if you can imagine that. And so I think that part of that is going to be thinking about how to organize time in a way where we can spend this time with students to actually value the experiences of the students themselves as well as the teacher, because we're all going through this together. And I think that the way that crisis mode has worked has made it so that everybody is being compassionate about everybody's experience. And I think, you know, keeping that at the center of teaching and of learning in general is something that we can do. And consistently being compassionate for each other and consistently showing up for each other and for ourselves is something that we can definitely recreate in a smaller environment. And we've seen teachers do that, right? We've seen them do it in the classroom already. And we've continued to see some of the teachers do that, you know, continuously as they've moved into this distance learning. So that's something that I can definitely see I see happening, but also can see continuing along in this next year, because I personally see this coming school year being completely online, but that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I have been thinking about is mathematics instruction in a virtual setting. I mean, there is not robust research to show that even the formats that teachers are using where it's a one-to-one, every student is on a device and the teacher rotates around the classroom, there is not robust research to show that that leads to mathematics learning. And it is so common. It's like this, you know, magic pill that people think is going to have some type of solution. And, you know, what we know works with reform-oriented, standards-based pedagogical practices, I think are going to be super hard in a virtual space. I mean, Maria, I'm sure you have so much to say about at the elementary level because you have manipulatives, you know, at the secondary level, like I think about using complex instruction and group work and selecting and sequencing, like, okay, this group is going to present and then this group is going to present. And then, you know, we're going to try to tie it all together. Right. I just don't know how that is going to happen in a virtual setting. And so
not going to happen well.
Yeah. I would love to hear your thoughts also on this, Maria.
Absolutely.
Oh, I don't know. I have lots of things to say. I mean, I'm going to be on sabbatical in the fall, but I'll probably, when I come back in the spring, I probably will still be teaching online classes. I really want to think about better ways to make those initial connections. I have found that the autobiographies are so important, but I also don't know about, this is old milk. I don't know about asking a teacher to read 80 to 120 autobios for high school students, but there's got to be, you know, I have to get this one milk. There's got to be a way to gather data, right? Not data, but like learn about each other more efficiently.
I mean, I used to, when I was teaching high school, and this was actually from the CPM book, is that I wrote an introductory letter to students. They wrote a letter to me. That was their very first homework assignment. And then I would comment back to them. You know, sometimes they would suggest to me a book that they just read. And I would write like, oh, thank you. You know, I'm going to get this book and read it. And then I would photocopy them because I wanted to be able to have to refer to, you know, like, oh, I remember this student said they had this interest. Like, let me go check, you know, and then I would hand it back to them. But again, it's, you know, I was also teaching with a block schedule. So it meant that I had half the number of total students, right, than I would have had if I was teaching periods.
But I guess there could still be like priority put on, if you're going to be using some kind of, you know, like everyone's using Google Classroom or whatever, like if the first assignment is like set up your profile, like ask the students to do some specific things, right? Because I know that's what we do with adults with iLearn is like often the first assignment is like update your profile picture, put a short biography so that we can start learning a little bit about each other, you know? Yeah, but I don't know this, I was also thinking like from the elementary world, wouldn't it be cool if, so this is me thinking more like a parent now, wouldn't it be cool if the teachers would make short videos for parents to watch with the kids that introduces themselves a little bit, that humanizes them a little bit, like, you know, remind the families that you're all in this together. Yeah, I don't know, now I'm sounding cheesy, but you know, that idea of like, hey, I'm here for your kid. I know a lot of what I'm doing, but we'll be learning together. Like to kind of get this, like, because I think the thing that I fear as a parent also is not being able to meet my son's teacher next year is the thing that's freaking me out a little bit. It's like, how am I supposed to just hand you over? And my son is going to be like, who are you? You know what I mean? Because he's not used to meeting people online. He's used to seeing people he's met online. So, you know, maybe that's less of an issue with the high school population, but I'm thinking like elementary, it's really, it's a strange terrain right now. So.
I think K-12 overall is going to be much more difficult than higher ed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I did a lot once we made the switch with the quarantine. You know, I did a one-on-one with every single student because you miss that you know, walking by, like, oh, you told me this thing last week, like, how's your student doing? You know, like those small moments, or not small, but, you know, like brief check-ins that you can do to follow up with students, you can't do in a Zoom online setting. And so, but I think at K-12 level, I just think it's much, much more difficult. Just worries me at the K-12 level, because I know that, or I feel that the reason that a lot of my students tried in math class was because of the relationship that we had and the trust that we had built.
So how do we keep that at the core while we move to these different platforms of teaching and learning? And yeah. You know, I was also thinking a lot about the role of instructional aides. Mm-hmm. And God, first of all, I hope they all get raises. Second, they're often the, and you know, especially if it's like the language instructional assistant for a student, they're often the person who has one of the best relationships with them, right? Because they've established a relationship built around language and trust and support and all those things. And I'm really wondering about how we think about the role of those teachers who are not credentialed or alleged, you know, quote unquote credentialed, or aren't supposed to be the one who's like the content expert or something, but they're highly like the relationship experts in a lot of schools. And I'm really curious to see like, how can they be supported to, you know, share their knowledge, do their work, and get paid for the work that they do fairly. And yeah, I'm really thinking about their role on the team this coming year.
You know, it's really interesting that you say that, because so I've, like, true to any Central American family, I have lots of family. And so I'm thinking about the cousins of mine that are in high school and in elementary school and in middle school currently. And one of the things that we've reflected on in the past, like pre-COVID, was thinking about the ways in which they make friends, and how oftentimes the ways in which they make friends at their school sometimes happens through social media platforms first, where they will, you know, see this other person's account who they have seen at school before, but they just don't talk to, but they'll interact with each other via social media, and perhaps only via social media, and then eventually will interact in person as well. And so I was thinking about how they have, and this particular generation has almost started to reimagine what virtual relationships can be, and the ways in which they can develop and still develop that kind of mutual respect and mutual valuing, and still be in community even though they're not necessarily interacting in person with each other. And I think that there's something to be said about that, and the knowledge that this generation brings with being able to develop that. And I think that that's something that should really be looked into a little bit more, is thinking about the ways in which these youth develop online communities, you know, and I'm even thinking about gamers, right? Like gamers develop these relationships, yeah, with people who they oftentimes don't even see in person,
right?
But they develop these relationships with people. And so it's very clear that it's a natural instinct for people to have relationships with other people, regardless of whether or not they can see them in person. And I think that for that reason, it gives me a little bit more hope. Yeah. In knowing that we are human, and so we will be building relationships with each other. It'll just be a matter of, you know, what is the medium that we use, and how can we continue, especially within math classes, to demonstrate that students can be trustworthy in our classrooms, right? Not trustworthy, but that they can trust us, and that we can create an environment of trust so that when mistakes do, quote unquote mistakes, when partial understandings, as I've been learning.
Understanding. That's what you call it, right, Maria? Current understandings?
Current.
Yeah, current partial understandings. Yeah, all those things are better than misconceptions, right?
Yeah, so my team your blog, Maria.
Yes. So we read that. And so in just thinking about those, you know, partial understandings that come up, what are the ways in which, and again, we're human, and as teachers, we do this consistently. How can we develop questions and questioning to demonstrate that we do care, that we do care about their learning, and that they can learn with us?
That's really beautiful. It's like you figured so much out, Bree.
I don't know about that.
I would like to invite you to keynote at whatever event I have coming up. I'm just really enjoying it. I want to thank Bree and Carrie for that stimulating discussion on how we think about our relationships with our students, how we think about our relationships professional to professional. These wonderful things for us to keep thinking about. Some reminders from TOTOS. We will be participating in NCTM's 100 Days of Professional Learning all of next week. That's the week of July 6th. And hopefully this podcast does indeed come out before then, like I hope. July 6th, join us for Amplifying Language and Sense-Making Routines with a Primary Grade Band Focus, presented by Nicole Lindgren. On the 7th, we'll have Rick Kitchen talk to us about supporting ELs through mathematical inquiry and the Discursive Assessment Protocol, with a target towards the middle school grades. The 8th, we'll have Translanguaging the Persevere, exploring Latinx bilingual students' collective problem solving, with speakers Hector Morales, Joseph DiNapoli, and Craig Willey. On the 9th, we have a general interest session for you all, Humanizing Online Mathematics Teaching, Possibilities and Resistance, with guest speakers Mary Raigosa, Kelsey Macias, and Nima Harirchian. Those all start at 4 p.m. PST, 7 p.m. EDT. Be sure to check that out. Check out our website for more details. Following that, our week of TOTOS webinars will conclude on Friday with a 10 a.m. PT or 1 p.m. EDT topic, a panel on the changing landscape of mathematics education. We have 5 panelists representing various positions in mathematics education across the U.S. who will share their reflections and ideas on the following questions. What do schools need to be prioritizing around mathematics teaching and learning for this fall? What about in the long term? What actions could and should the world of mathematics education be taking? That is going to be quite a panel, quite a discussion. We urge you to sign up and join. Again, details at our website. Well, that concludes our first ever season of the TOTOS Mathematics for All podcast. I have been your host, Maria Zavala. I'm definitely looking forward to all the goodness that we're going to be bringing you in season 2. So revisit our episodes from season 1 all summer, and sometime early September, we will be launching into season 2 of the TOTOS Mathematics for All podcast. Bueno, seguimos luchando. Adios.